91.3 KXCI Tucson, Real People, Real Radio. Thanks so much for joining us here on 91.3 FM. It is time for the classic pick. This is when Chris Carey comes in every Monday at 4 o'clock to tell us what he's chosen, what he's reviewed, and what he's got going on. Today, he has a special guest with him. Jim Waters is here. We're going to find out more about Jim and why he was invited in the studio today. Take it away, Chris.
So today, Hannah's not here today, and I still came in to talk about the classic pick of the week. And as you may or may not know, we always try to pick a album that's come out on an anniversary. And this month, it's the 25th anniversary of Sonic Youth's Goo, which was released June 26, 1990, 25 years ago. While I was doing this research, I realized that Tucson's own Jim Waters worked on the demo recordings when he was in New York. And that was in, what, early 89?
I guess it was.
I mean,
about 25 years ago.
Yeah. I know this came out in 90. So it came out in June of 1990. So maybe late 89. And I didn't realize that Waterworks, I knew Waterworks as a Tucson studio, right. But I didn't realize that.
Yeah, started out in New York. It was an 8-track studio originally. And we were on 14th Street in the Meatpacking District, which was really a charming place to have a studio. But it had a lot of personality and people appreciated that. But anyway, so yeah. So I worked with a lot of the downtown kind of bands in New York at that time. It started with, people from John Spencer, Blues Explosion came in, and all the offshoots of that kind of band. And from there, Sonic Youth and all these other people came in. And that's how I got involved in the Goo demos.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, so they were a New York band from the get-go, correct?
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, they were blowing up at that point. It was interesting time because at that moment, indie rock suddenly became, they grew up, you know, and the major labels started signing everything that moved, you know, anything uh-huh. indie rock. They didn't know what it was, but they jumped on it. And Sonic Youth was kind of the first one. It was the test, you know.
Yeah, because Daydream Nation, I think, was on Enigma, and then before that, they were SST, I think.
Yeah, there's a variety of things. I don't know if Enigma. Daydream Nation sold like hundreds of thousands of copies, and that's when the major labels stepped in and said, "Oh, this is something that people like. We don't like it, but I think people could buy it."
Yeah, and so they recorded the whole album first on 8-track, and then
right.
And then was it David Geffen himself that decided he didn't want to release anything on 8-track?
No, he wasn't. It wasn't him. It was, who was their A&R guy? I can't even remember his name anymore. Uh-huh. But it's the guy that signed Nirvana and a bunch of people. He was infamous at that point.
Uh-huh.
And I can't think of his name. So,
I don't have that either. But I did read that. So that this came out in 90. This was like the first band signed to David Geffen's indie label DGC, right?
Exactly, yeah. Huh?
And then soon thereafter they signed Nirvana, and then kind of
right.
And then it took off. Obviously, the label
right.
that made a lot of money, still probably making them a lot of money.
Sure enough, yeah.
But so the thing I was interested about too is you said that I know you sent me a note last night that said the thing you remembered was them all coming in the studio with a bunch of jazz masters that the pickups were held in with
tape. They were just
tape.
Busted up guitars. I didn't believe any of them could play, but they worked. You know, they would jam the cord in there and typically they would buy a guitar because it was tuned really messed up, and they wouldn't mess with the tuning after that. They would kind of just leave it, you know, like, wow, that's a weird chord. Cool, leave it.
You know? And and Sonic Youth was known for alternative
right.
tunings, right?
Right.
So they were well, and I think too, as I read stuff that Thurston got to be a real Dr. Frankenstein with guitars anyway. He would take necks from one guitar and jam them
sure.
into the body of another.
Right.
So maybe this is kind of the beginning of that.
Yeah, or maybe it was
midstream.
Yeah, totally. They seem pretty comfortable with it.
Yeah. And what was funny too is I didn't realize until I read this that it's funny how much in the late 80s and early 90s that Jay Maskus was involved in indie music, not just in Dinosaur Jr., but he seemed to be doing a lot. Like, he had his fingers in a lot. And you said that he was there and had co-productive
yeah.
engineering.
Well, he was dragged in. Sonic Youth was kind of worried about seeming that they were selling out. Uh-huh. And so they try to do this, let's get Jay involved here. If he's involved with this, no one can say it's sold out, you know, because he's Mr. Give Me Indie Rock, you know.
Yeah.
And so they were trying to just downplay all the we signed to a major label thing. And so they had him come in, and he had actually really no interest in it at all. But he was a really funny guy. They were buddies, uh-huh. kind of like they're indie buddies, kind of. I don't know how close they were, but they hung out enough that.
They were based, and Dinosaur Jr. is based in Boston, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. And they seemed to kind of know each other, but basically, when they were rehearsing in the next room, Jay and me and Don would sit in the control room, and they would turn the sound off, and they just smoked dope and watch soap operas. That was Jay's favorite thing to do.
And when I was reading that, it was kind of funny that him and who else?
Don there
was
Fleming.
Oh, yeah. They were the guys on the song Goo that did the, hey, Goo, what's new?
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess, you know, I wanted to find out, too, is I read now, again, this is internet research, but I read somewhere that at some point DGC tried to get them to get Daniel Lanois to record the 24 track, and that somehow that they ended up going with
Ron St. Germain.
Yeah,
you know, that was the thing that was really difficult for them to swallow, is that they were still an indie band, but suddenly there was all these major label uh-huh. rules that they had to follow, and that was, you know, there's certain studios you can work at, there's certain producers you can work with, here's the list, check it out. And they went down the list, and they couldn't find anyone that they wanted. But they were given a certain amount of leverage where they could choose from a list, at least. And the only reason they chose the guy they chose was he had worked on some jazz records and Thurston's a huge jazz guy. He's huge into, like, he's got a room, an apartment that's, you know, couple floors of this, that's just jazz records. That's all it is. He doesn't live there. He stores his jazz records in there.
That's pretty cool.
That's amazing. Uh-huh. So that's why they chose him. Uh-huh. And he didn't care about the band. He didn't understand what this shit was at all. Excuse my words. French.
Yeah.
But he would show up like in S&M gear all the time. And like there was just no connection whatsoever.
Yeah.
And, but you know, they just kind of got along. They just tried to make it happen. So anyway.
Well, I mean, the band themselves kind of had the final say on all the edits and everything. I mean, they did that. They at least have co-production credit, right?
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, yeah. What did bring you to Tucson? I was going to think that, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't really a big fan of living in New York. I like blue. I grew up in a place in Wisconsin where there's outdoors and there's rivers and water to go swimming and lakes and ponds and blue skies, and it's like New York didn't, as it turns out, didn't have any of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, it had a lot of gray buildings, and it just was depressing for me to live there. And at some point, I said, you know, I'm going to kill myself if I live here much longer. So, as it turns out, my parents had moved here,
uh-huh.
and I came visiting them one year during the winter, and I went, this is a nice place during the winter. I don't need to go back to New York, you know.
Huh. And so, when was that?
We visited them sometime in the 80s. I don't know.
Huh.
Then we moved here in 1993.
Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, just not long after this came out.
Yeah, a few years, yeah.
Yeah. What are you working on that you're excited about right now?
Oh, God, there's so many things that I'm working on. Jeez, do you have to do that to me? I'm working on it with a band called Jazz Telephone, which is really... really great. I don't know if you know them, Andrew Kohlberg and Jeff Rubin.
Yeah, they're great.
Doing a lot of stuff with a band called Free Machines that we just finished, and Freezing Hands. They're kind of with Lollipop Records. Dimitri from
Golden Boots.
Right. He's doing a solo project called American Monoxide, and we've been working on that a lot.
Yeah,
so I'm in the middle of mixing that.
That album he released not too long ago, was that self-record? Did he record that on his own, or did he do that?
He always records on his own. It's just he came to my studio to mix a lot of it.
Uh-huh. Did they do Labyrinth at Waterworks? I don't know. Dimitri did something with Ryan, right? So it was kind of Golden Boots.
I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember that. When was that?
Maybe a year ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember.
Yeah, no, those guys.
I do too many things. Well, and those to guys remember
are,
what I do.
And those guys do a ton of stuff too. They're
always
doing stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that, oh, I know what I wanted to talk, because the first song we were going to play this week is Cool Thing.
Yeah.
And you were saying that, I know I read that originally it was sort of kind of, Kim Gordon had recently done a interview with LL Cool J that was published in Spin. And at first they kind of thought about getting LL Cool J to do the rap parts on the song, but then she kind of was turned off by LL Cool J.
She actually wrote the song about him because she thought his music was, you know, she thought he was really hot and all this kind of stuff. But then when she met him, she just felt like there wasn't a lot of personality there, you know, and it was kind of like, well, let's get someone else that's exciting or at least excited about the project.
Yeah.
You know?
And then Chuck D ended up.
Right, right.
Which, and I know that Nick Sansano, who worked on that record, the tie-in, and I was wondering if you knew about that, because I know that I read that Nick Sansano, he did a lot of engineering on the last two Public Enemy records at that time. So he did, like, It Takes a Nation of Millions and Fear of Black Planet. But then he was working with them on this, and then he did on Daydream Nation, and I thought maybe he introduced them to Chuck D.
Well, you know, they were kind of darlings of the music industry at that point, and everyone was hanging out and wanting to get to know them. They were kind of a big buzz, so, you know, and they kind of always threw themselves into whatever the scene was, you know, and they were involved in so many different music projects all the time. So, you know, it was probably inevitable that they would meet and hang out and talk, you know.
Well, it was cool that Chuck D was on that anyway, it's Chuck D. He's pretty...
Absolutely.
He's like the James Joyce of hip-hop. Yeah. Anyway... Okay. Well, thanks very much, Jim.
Not a problem.
I appreciate you coming down and talking to me.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Have a good week.
I will. Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Okay.